This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 75 of What's It Like. My guest is Alex Lindsay, somewhere north of San Francisco. Hey, Alex.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good. So did you grow up in that area?
I did not. I've lived in a lot of places, but this is my most recent one. I've been here for, I think I've been in Petaluma for about 3 years, which is where I live right now. And before that, I was in San Francisco and all over the Bay Area. And then before that, I was in Denver. And then before that, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, wow. Best known for its football.
Yes, I am a big Pittsburgh Steeler fan. People ask me now that I'm out here, if I'm in the 49ers, I'm like, no, I'm, you know, Steelers isn't really a football thing in Pittsburgh. It's more of a religion.
Yes, I would think.
and leaving it, you know, you worry, you know, even if you leave Pittsburgh, you worry about the health of your soul if you started to, your football soul, if you started to actually root for another team.
Did you come from a large family?
I did. I came from a large family of large families. Mm. So I think the current count is 57 cousins.
Oh my goodness!
From both sides, but I had about, I'm the oldest of six, and my parents were in 7 and 8 kids themselves. So it's just it's a brood.
Ah, firstborn. You know what they say about the firstborns. You know.
All trouble.
Yes, but also intelligent and have lots of authority and responsibilities.
All of that. My family is such a group of individuals that really get along together very, very well. So it's just a very interesting, you know, each one of my brothers and sisters is very different, but we all still enjoy, I mean, after, you know, all these years, we still really enjoy being around each other, which is unique, I think.
How fun. What was the biggest influence on your life when you were growing up?
I don't know if I could say the biggest influence. There were so many, you know, because just you live in this big family and you live with a lot of people that were extended. You know, I mean, obviously my parents are going to be a massive influence on who I became and what they thought was important and how they approached it. You know, I had great parents. You know, my mom had a master's in child development. So I think we were a big research project for her. and so she was constantly kind of, experimenting with ways to raise us, which I see myself doing now with my kids, which is a lot of fun. And so I had a lot of, a lot of input obviously from my parents directly. And then I had an uncle, my uncle Sid, who was, he was my mom's brother, and he was just over at the house a lot over the weekends and stuff like that. And he was an engineer. And so I think that definitely, impacted my interest in that. And oddly enough, I got into computers mostly through my grandfather, who, was a geek before geeks were geeks. You know, he picked up the first radio broadcast from KDKA in 1921 with a crystal radio set that he had built. And actually the first computer I started playing with was his computer over at his house. And so I think those are some of the, but there were so many people. There were so many friends and family. We, almost all of my dad's family lived within a mile of our house. And so it was just this huge, you know, group of people that you were constantly interacting with.
Had your own village, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was definitely what my grandfather had kind of slowly purchased. He was a lawyer, and he had slowly purchased this farmland over many, many, many years whenever it was available. And so he had all these little farmhouses, and he just slowly encouraged his kids to live in them. so he, that kind of kept them around in the, anyway, the price was right. And so there's a lot of family that he was able to kind of keep around in that area, which created a very interesting dynamic.
What was your major challenge as a child?
My major challenges when I was a child, I think that, I would say almost that my major, what served me well as my major challenge was that I was extremely, headstrong. So, you know, I would just do what I'm going to do. And it was very difficult for my poor parents to get me to do anything that I wasn't going to do. I had my nickname when I was a kid was Captain Bennyman, because I would stand on my stroller and just point, this is where I want to go, over here, you know, and I never really changed, you know. So I got myself into a lot of trouble that way. I mean, you know, just going down whatever path I was going, whether it was good or bad. But I also, you know, I think that, you know, as a challenge, you know, also I grew up not reading very well. So I was, very dyslexic and also Fair, I guess today they would call it. Back then they just called me hyper, but I think they would call me ADD or ADHD or whatever today. And so I was, you know, just very, you know, I was focused when I needed to be, but most of the time I was very interested in many, many, many different things and oftentimes all at the same time.
Then what was school like for you?
School was not a particularly exciting experience for me. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was something that I have to admit that I kind of viewed as this, and I hate to say it this way, but as most of my childhood, I kind of viewed school as this purgatory I had to be in for a certain amount of time before I got to go back to doing whatever I was doing, which was usually a lot of research and playing around. I mean, I loved to learn. I just didn't like school. Mm-hmm. You know, so I didn't, you know, I had a hard time keeping up with reading assignments because I wasn't very fast at it. And so it was really good if you gave me a, as long as the teacher talked about everything in class, I didn't need to take notes. I didn't need to, you know, mostly I just drew pictures while I was in class, but I was able to absorb everything. But I wasn't able to, you know, the reading part I didn't do as well. If there's lots of pictures, I could absorb it a lot, you know, I could absorb it very quickly. So I, you know, a lot, there were a lot of challenges there. I wasn't the most, I guess, well-adjusted kid in school. I mean, I was always a little, you know, I kind of fit into the, I didn't really fit into any group. I think that was the issue. By the time I got to high school, I was both a jock. You know, I played, I started in football and wrestling. And, but at the same time, I was also the guy who really liked physics and was kind of a geek as well. And so I just didn't really fit in pretty much anywhere. So you know, it was fine. I mean, it was, as I said, it was something that I waited to get out of. So I tried college for a little while and just got out of that too.
So what exactly do you do?
You know, that's such a complicated question. Because the ADHD or ADD or whatever that I talked about earlier has really never really gone away. So there's a lot of things that I do. But, you know, I have a couple companies that I started. After I left, you know, I worked at Industrial Light and Magic and Lucasfilm. And after I left there, I started my own companies. And so I first started a company called the Pixel Core. And then, DV Garage was the first one. And then Pixel Core. DV Garage builds products for the industry. It was just, it's an outlet for me when about product, related to products and training that I felt like was missing when I was trying to move forward or things that I think that are still needed. And so DV Garage, we make some keen software and some training. And a variety of other pieces of tools, and we're working on a lot for this next year. And then Pixel Core was really a organization that, you know, I just really felt like there was something missing as far as organizing people around the world to help them find each other a bit faster and to get work done. And also trying to experiment with ways to train people faster. It was something that, you know, as I said, I loved learning. And I thought that it was always the teacher's fault that it wasn't working until I was actually teaching at a college realized that the entire structure was not something that really gave itself to teaching skills. So the Pixel Core is kind of a big lab for me to kind of figure that out. And then I also have another company called Rebel Unit, which is just does production. It's just a straight production company that does production for a variety of clients.
Hmm. What's the best thing about your job?
I guess it's that I really feel like it makes a difference. You know, I think that when I get up in the morning, I'm worried about how this is going to impact the world. I feel like it could impact the world. I think that media production in itself is the end of a point. You know, it's kind of the point end of revolutionizing the way that we learn and communicate and understand each other. And so I don't really look at media production as filmmaking or TV or entertainment. I really look at it as kind of holistically as this this process of more efficiently communicating using media. And so I, you know, to me, all the stuff that we do fits into that little mm-hmm. puzzle.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
I think that the worst thing about my job is that I don't get to spend enough time with my family. Mm. I mean, I think, you know, that's right now my job is very, it's very busy. And I spend a lot of time in, you know, a lot of parts of the world. You know, in December, I think I was in a couple different continents alone. And, you know, this year looks like it'll be as busy as it was before. And I think that I have two older kids and they live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then I have two younger kids who are now 2 and 4. And, you know, everybody grows up so quickly. and you just feel like, you know, missing them for a chunk of time is a bit of a bummer. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to do better. I took my older daughter, who's 16, Hannah, to Japan with me the last time I went a couple weeks ago. And I'm trying to do more of that, as well as just trying to find other ways that I can. A lot of times I'll come home, even if it's for a day or two, and it doesn't necessarily make sense. I'll come home just to see my kids, just for, you know, even if it's just for the morning and the afternoon, and then I'll go off again, just to kind of have them not feel like I'm gone forever.
Mm-hmm. If one wanted to, how would one get a job like yours?
I don't know how you get a job like mine. Mine is a very complicated job. I mean, it's the in the industry, I think that, I mean, and I think, I guess I, what I would back up and say, how would you get a job that you really want to do? And I think that there is, regardless of whether it's my job or somebody else's, I think that one of the things that you have to get back in touch with is what you're passionate about. I think that you need to figure that out. And I think that, and I don't mean to sound too rough about this, but I think that oftentimes if you're not careful, K-12 school kind of beats it out of you, you know, to the point where you don't know what's important to you anymore. You don't know what's important. You know what you needed to do to get an A, but you don't necessarily know what you're passionate about, because everything's kind of been pushed to the point of you know, being painful, you know. And so, and I don't mean to sound so negative about school, but I think that it's important for people to find what they're passionate about, and then it's important to figure out, in my opinion, how you apply what you're passionate about to the world in a way that makes a difference. And I think that and what I mean is, it has to serve a use in the world. And I think that you have to figure out what it's going to do. Like, how does it change people's lives? It doesn't have to change thousands of people's lives when I say it, but it has to be something that's providing a use for people. So a lot of people are very good. So once they get over the fact that they know, they figure out what they want to do, a lot of times they're trying to figure out what they want to do, but they're not figuring out how it impacts the world. Like, how does this really make a difference? And then you have to figure out, you know, how to structure that. But the structuring part is, I think, and sometimes the simplest thing. The biggest thing is figuring it out. And if it's not, if people aren't reacting to what you're doing positively or reacting at all, then you may be right on with what you're passionate about, but you may not be right on with how it impacts the world. And so you need to, you know, constantly be looking at how you're gonna plug in, you know, how you're gonna be part of that equation that moves the world forward. And as I said, it doesn't have to be grandiose. It doesn't, you know, mine's grandiose. It doesn't have to be. I don't know how I got myself into this mess.
What type of person would be good at your job?
I think that a type of person that's good at what I do is someone who, doesn't need a lot of sleep, and B is, tends to be very focused on small details. My wife was talking to me this morning, actually, about the fact that I'm oddly good at many different things, but it's not that I'm good at, it's not that I have specific skills. What I have is intensity and a lot of attention to odd details, you know? And so I can learn a lot of things and get better at them. So I think it's someone who can be intense about learning these things, intense about moving them forward, and also really paying attention to the small details that make it work. You know, I oftentimes didn't, you know, I used to think, you know, talk to people about visual effects and visual effects artists. And I'd say the big thing about visual effects artists is that we want to think of artists in kind of a warm, fuzzy sort of way. But a lot of times a visual effects artist is someone who's just simply really, really good at paying attention to lots and lots of very, very small details. You're looking at, you know, visual effects artists will look at a, you know, a fork and be playing with it and looking at the rounds around the edges and how the light goes across it and where the scratches are. And those are all little things. And then they reapply those. And the application of those in work, at work, is fairly mechanical. I mean, anybody can do it. It's being able to see that that process that I think is important.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
A typical day, yeah, there's not that many typical days, but they do fall into certain groups. When I'm not, there's usually, you know, Tuesdays are my on-air day when I'm on a couple different shows and stuff like that. But I, outside of that, there is when I'm not traveling, so traveling is about 30% of my, this is what happens. I mean, there's no typical day, but there's on a day that I'm not on air and I'm not traveling. Typically I get up pretty early. I like to get up somewhere between 4 and 5 in the morning. I feel like I'm when I get up at that point in time, I feel like I'm ahead. When I get up at 7 or 8 in which I did, I do over the breaks. But when I get up like that on a work day, I feel like I've started in the middle of the day and I never really catch up. So I start off early and I usually, you know, I get my coffee and I work out for about an hour and then I kind of organize stuff to get ready to go. I don't really do anything useful until 7 and then I'm on phone calls. Oftentimes on a typical day, I'll be on phone calls for a couple hours. These are with different people, different stakeholders in our company, talking to them about what's happening, where we're going. And when I'm traveling, it doesn't happen as often or when things get really crazy, but when things kind of settle in, that's typically what happens. So that I kind of keep in touch with everybody. And then by 9 o'clock or so, I'm then working on, stuff. So usually it's planning, planning pieces of things. So, I spend a lot of time in, you know, numbers, a spreadsheet, trying to kind of figure out, you know, how much things are going to cost and calculating things and, figuring out those pieces, and figuring out what we have to do next. And then, you know, then in the afternoon, I kind of do more of the same, but usually my goal is usually to try to get as much done, like the things that absolutely have to get done, I try to get done before lunch. Like, so that like that day is not a failure if I get these things done before noon or 1 o'clock. Then in the afternoon, I tend to be a lot more relaxed. I tend to walk around and figure things out and noodle with things and allow my brain to kind of, relax a little bit. Mm-hmm. And still get things done. And I usually I'll try to schedule, unless the other person's scheduling, I'll almost always try to schedule my meetings in the afternoon so that I can have that kind of focus time in the morning. And then I talk to lots of people in the afternoon and I do a lot of those other things. So that's about as typical as I can. I usually finish it, you know, finish where I start at 7 and I usually finish somewhere near 7. So it's kind of a pretty straightforward process.
Alex, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, I think the biggest kick in my pants is that there is so much I'm accountable for on a, you know, day-to-day basis. I kind of have a state of terror half the time of all the things that need to get done. And these are, and they're all things that I created. I mean, that's the one, that's the one blessing of what's in front of me is that what is in front of me is the mess that's in front of me is the mess that I created generally. And so what I need to do is figure out how to, you know, get it out and figure out how to do that. Now I do get inspired by watching movies or listening to music, definitely movies that make a difference, you know, or I feel like, you know, are inspiring on the weekends are great when I can. a lot of times I watch a lot of movies and I watch a lot of TV shows while I'm biking. I stationary bike in the morning pretty hard and I get very bored. So I'm usually into some TV show or some movie while I'm doing it to kind of keep me focused. Mostly I'm inspired and I get inspired by reading. I'm a philosophy major. Then the time that I did spend in school, I started in electrical engineering and then somehow ended up in psychology and then somehow ended up in anthropology and then ended up in Eastern philosophy and kind of simmered in Eastern philosophy for a while. And then I just, you know, if you study Eastern philosophy long enough, you realize that it's all empty and meaningless anyway, and then you drop out. And so you, I definitely do read a lot of a pretty wide range of philosophical works on a fairly regular basis. I'd say almost every day I'm listening to or reading something that's in that kind of angle. So it can be anything from, you know, mystic Christian to Taoism to Zen Buddhism to I don't really read a lot of Western philosophers. I mean, like the 18th century, 19th century, like what I tend to call quote unquote dead philosophy. So you know, that I don't feel like has any life. I think it's a lot of thinking and not a lot of application. So I don't read a lot of that, but I read a lot of the things outside of that.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I do things that are manual. So probably my number one thing to do when I need to calm down is I clean my house. What I mean by clean my house, I have a back office, which is a second house. My wife has the front house. So it's kind of like her house and my house. I'm currently in my house, for instance, and it's nice and quiet and there's kids aren't running around screaming and it's got a radio, you know, radio and TV stuff all around. It's always out of order because I'm usually busy. But usually one of my ways of relaxing is that I like to, listen to an audiobook. I'll pick some audiobook that I'm working through, or I'll listen to NPR or that type of thing, or listen to The Economist, and then I'll wander around and clean my house. And if I'm here a lot, you'll notice, because if you walk into my house and it's super clean, it means I've been around for a long time. And if it looks like it's a bomb got dropped in, it means I've been traveling a lot because I just drop things off, pick things up and move on. But the, I usually, that is one of the ways I calm myself. I also like to cook. So I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily a great cook, but I have lots of toys. So I have like a sous vide cooker and a big green egg. And so I fiddle a lot with cooking. And I think that, that is another kind of manual process that requires me to not do something on my computer. That usually helps with me calming down. And I guess the final thing is I hang out with my family. So that's probably the number one thing. You know, like if I'm really stressed, just going out and roughhousing with my kids is usually probably the number one, or hanging out with my wife and talking to her about stuff is usually the number one way that calms me down.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Oh, there's been so many. I think that, there have been, it's hard for me to put my finger on one moment that, you know, there have been so many events where I didn't know how I was going to get to the other side. And I think that that's important to have a lot of those. I don't necessarily know I would, you know, it's one of those things you look back on and I wouldn't want to do it again. You know, I mean, but at the same time, is definitely in that range of whatever, you know, doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so there's, I think over time I'm harder to rouse as far as, cause like, you know, it's easier to see. There's been a lot of things, whether it's, in high school, I hit my head and I had what was later diagnosed as a closed head injury, in gymnastics. And, my personality changed a lot. And I became a little more aggressive and a little bit more forgetful than normal. And didn't make it through my senior year in the prep school that I was going to. And, my whole life, flipped for a little while, and it took a good decade for it to flip back. And it's interesting that, that was kind of a, what I tend to refer to as a 40 years in the wilderness kind of thing, or 15 really years in the wilderness, or so on and so forth. And so where I think that was an important part of my life, but it was, and it's not like I didn't do anything. I did a lot of things in the middle of all of that, but I think that there was a lot of, pieces that I had to, challenge as far as who I thought I was and what I thought was important and all those other pieces. And I made a lot of mess along the way and then kind of, found my way back to being a little bit more settled. And, but there's, I think also starting a company is a really great idea if you really want to press yourself and push yourself. And it's a really horrible, idea if you want a predictable life. And so, especially, if you compound that by borrowing money from your family to do it, it's just, there is no, my wife once, we were getting pretty close to the ground with DV Garage and, really close to the ground. And she gave me one of those, what is plan B? If this doesn't work, what is plan B? And I was like, plan B is to make plan A work. and so that was kind of the, that was the, that's how I've kind of approached most of this. There is no plan B.
So let me ask you this. Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through your challenges?
There's a lot of them. When I grew up, I grew up in a Christian kind of, church school, or I didn't grow up in it. I spent a couple years in it. And I remember there was this one, something that never left me from that. And I've been all over the place when it comes to religion and everything else, but something that never left me was this quote from, I don't know what book it's in, probably Matthew or John or something like that. I don't know. Somewhere in the New Testament, it says, gather not for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt and where thieves break in and steal, but rather gather for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt and where thieves do not break through and steal. And the thing that became very interesting about that is that's probably one of the most important little, and for someone who, I don't quote it perfectly and then I say it's the most important thing for me, but what's interesting about that is that I used to think that what that meant was that it was a, that if you, if you were good, you'd end up in heaven, the treasures in heaven, and slowly my understanding of that really evolved, or my belief in that really evolved. And it kind of supersedes, what religion or anything else, you could call it kind of a karmic account, and really staying focused on the concept that, that if you you know, when you are doing good in the world, when you are serving a use, when you are moving things forward, you are creating treasures, you know, in heaven or good karma or whatever you want to call it. And you are improving, you know, you're building what I, you know, again, you're building an account, you know, and that account of goodwill that you're building up it's a really fascinating thing, because it is something that continues to benefit you on this world, not necessarily after you die. You don't have to believe in the other world to have this be important. Is that when you know, I always look at it as long as I'm producing use, and as long as I'm serving other people, and as long as I'm pushing things down the path that are important to the world, that things will sort themselves out. You know, they will, you know, because I'll, you know, they will get converted, you know, like that goodwill converts itself back to you know, what I need to pay the bills as it's needed. You know, and I try not, you know, and the more you use it, it's kind of like, and then I really started getting mathematical about it, which is, you know, and I started thinking of it, it's like my, you know, your karmic stock, you know, and you don't want to sell principal. So you don't want to ask people for too much too often. But a lot of times, you know, a lot of that stuff keeps on coming back to you as long as you're doing good things. I think that the good, you know, friend of mine, Leo Laporte, is a great example of someone who does an enormous amount of great things, you know, and really, you know, comes from the right place as he starts to, you know, the what he looks at and what he considers, you know, his focus on the integrity of his message around the tech industry and making sure that he's not being swayed one way or the other and making a difference. You know, what you see on the other side of that is an enormous amount of groundswell. He gets an enormous amount of support when it comes to advertising, when it comes to people buying bricks on his wall, you know, to, you know, all of those things are a great example of that concept of this idea that you are, as long as you are, you know, doing those things, you know, and you'll know whether you're doing those things because you have that reservoir or you don't. And so I really keep on trying to check in with whether I'm, you know, that's what I'm doing. It won't be every day, but I definitely try to make sure that I'm thinking about that and thinking about whether I'm, you know, providing more than I'm asking for, whether I'm, you know, pushing things forward, whether I'm doing something that really is going to positively impact the world in whatever way that I think is important. You know, I mean, that's the goal. You know, I don't think that what we're doing is the most important thing in the world, but I think that this is the piece that I got. You know, this is, you know, I'm in my background with my history and everything else, the you know, the role that I choose to play to help this giant, huge process of moving the world forward happens to be related to media. And there's many other people that do many other things, you know, that, and all of those things are necessary. And I just simply have this one little piece to play with.
If you were giving a commencement address for High Score College, giving your best advice, what would you say?
I would, you know, it's a very good question. So the main thing that I would say is that what is important as you start to enter the world is to understand that our world is changing very quickly, you know, and you have to understand that an enormous, if you're looking for a job, if you're going out to plan your future, that the world is very quickly aggregating towards the best and the cheapest, and there's not a lot in between, and you need to be focused on how you want to be one or the other. And it doesn't mean that you should, it doesn't mean that there isn't room for everybody. There is room, but you have to figure out what that is. And best can be the best of a very small little puzzle. The best could be the best of a very large one, but you have to decide, you know, what that's going to look like. But you really have to find something unique that you excel at, that you can stand out in, or you need to find ways to not have your overhead be too high, because you won't, you know, there's going to be a lot of challenges that are in front of you, especially in the United States. And I think that is the thing that is, you know, I feel like, you know, I look at a lot of the students when I was in school. When I was in school, I was, you know, I did fine. You know, I mean, my grades were fine. My parents, you know, wouldn't put up with a lot less than A's. And so if I didn't get A's in high school or college, I they left me alone as long as I got good grades. So they, but what I mean by leaving me alone is I did a lot of other things. So what you need to do is you need to find a specialty. You need to find you know, what you're going to do. A lot of people are trying to go after an industry because that industry is hot. Well, if that industry is not something you're going to excel at, the chances of you getting a job in that area or keeping that job is going to be very, very challenging. Of course, you might be able to get it in the short term, but you have to keep on looking at where you're going to excel and where you're going to stick out. What's happening is what's really fascinating about what's going on is that, you know, when we want to buy something now, when I want to buy something, I go to the best restaurants because I can go up on Yelp and look at what everyone else has already decided is the best restaurant, you know, and the mediocre restaurants, the ones that aren't unique, or the ones that that are just the same as everything else. You know, what's happening as we as consumers become more able, and it's not that it's all happened yet, but when we look in the future, we as consumers are becoming, you know, this hive mind is becoming very, very potent, where we make decisions very quickly based on what a lot of other people have already done and reviewed and figured out, and we decide whether we like their views and so on and so forth. But the point is that we keep on becoming more and more efficient about making those choices. And the stuff in the middle that isn't unique, that is simply another one of those things. You know, the thing what was very, very popular is that you would make lots and lots of different versions of things, or lots of, you know, because we could, we had machines that would do it, we had factories to make all these things. But now what's sticking out is what is unique or what is very specialized to what I'm interested in. And I can very quickly, you know, buy it, let's say on Amazon, and have it here tomorrow, you know, for free or for $3.99 or whatever it is. And so the issue is that we're doing that as consumers. So we a lot of times we want to say that it's the big industry that's making it hard for people to get jobs and everything else. But as consumers, we are becoming very, very picky about how we about what we're buying. And in the same way, you know, employers are becoming very, very picky about who they hire. You know, we think of Monster.com and a lot of these other, you know, employment areas as a real, it makes it a lot easier for you to get a job. What it really does is it makes it a lot easier for employers to find the ones they want. And so they're no longer geographically constrained. They no longer are time constrained. They're able to sort through large numbers of people very quickly. And so the issue is that a lot of the online tools, whether it's tools that make corporations more efficient or companies more efficient, and I'm not talking about big corporations. I'm not even talking about, you know, a little company that's got 10 people that now, you know, can be more efficient with their sales staff. Well, more efficient means that we need less, you know, less people to do the same thing. And so the thing is it's not, you know, it's not the big corporation against the little guy. It's just that the trend is that these companies are doing more and more with less and less people. And so what they're looking for, you know, what these companies are looking for, what we're looking for, when I look at my company's got like 10 people, we're looking for people who, can create on their own. They can figure stuff out if you put it there, but they also understand that there are ways that things have to get done, and they are, you know, reliable. They're accountable. They show up on time. They have good energy when they're there. They don't complain all the time. They can be focused and don't pull everybody else's focus out. They work hard and they don't complain a lot. And I don't mean complain like it's fine to talk about things that need to get changed. That's great. But, you know, what you need are people who, you know, get that some things are going to be hard and some things are going to be easy. And we do need to keep on improving it. But we also don't need to, you know, constantly have this kind of negative zone about what's going on and how it, you know, all these little things should be better and everything else. We want to keep on paying attention to those things without constantly bringing them up. And these are all things that, as an employer, this is what we're looking for. And so when we're looking for people to come into work with us, we're looking for people who, that are looking for, they're interested not so much in themselves, but in they really into creating something, you know, and if they can be focused into creating something, and that part of that's the employer's job, is to focus them on something big enough that they're energized. But you want to see that being able to be self-generating to some point. And so we train a lot of people. We go through a lot of people around the world. When I say go through them, I mean we put them through a lot of training, and we kind of cherry pick people, you know, to work for us and to freelance for us and to, you know, and but that's the kind of stuff we're looking for, you know. And I think that you know, I think that's not really a commencement speech, but those would be the kind of things that I talk about, is that people need to be very focused. I think that if you're going to college right now, if there's an entry speech, you need to know that, you know, partying in school is not going to be congruent to having a job when you get out. You know, you really, it's really going to be much more challenging as the folks entering college right now. I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news, but there's a lot of people who look at college as like a state of, you know, it's a rite of passage, and they're going to do all this crazy stuff, and they're going to join the fraternity, and they're going to do all these other things. It is important to be social. It is important to learn all those skills, but the, you know, that kind of lost 4 years that a lot of people turn college into, you know, they're going to end up living at their parents' house, you know, and that's the, you really have to figure out, you have to use that time to figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life and figure out how you're going to get it done. You may not learn everything you need to learn in college to do that, but you need to use that. That's kind of a safe time, to make that happen. And I think that is the, and if you're coming out of high school, I would say, figure that out before you go to college. Like, don't feel like you need to go the next year. My daughter's going to graduate next year. And she asked me what I thought. And I was like, you know, I think you should go travel around the world. I can get you jobs, you know, to work in different countries. You just spend the next 2 to 4 years just traveling around the world, see the world, figure stuff out. And then when you know what you want to do, then go to college. You know, I think that's the, in my opinion, that's a real challenge, is that this kind of, we go right out of high school into college, and then we want to release ourselves in that area. And I think that people need to know that it's going to be a different, it's going to continue. If you're in the United States, you're at the top of the mountain. You know, if you're playing, you know, king of the mountain, you know, when it comes from a financial perspective and everything else, everyone's gunning for you. Everyone's trying to compete with you. And where they can compete is in price, you know, and they're going to do that all over the world. And so if you don't want to compete in that area, that's fine. But you need to make sure that you're standing out. And there's plenty of work in the United States. There's plenty. I mean, there are so many employers. We're always looking for people. There's plenty of employers looking for people. The hard part is finding the right people. And it's usually less of an issue of skill and more of an issue of, you know, focus and drive.
You were pretty hard on education before, and yet you say you do training for your employees. How do you do it differently than you think normal education does it?
Well, I wouldn't say that we have it right yet. And so we have the Pixel Corps is a guild. So we actually, they're not our employees. They're people that have, you know, it's almost 1,000 people in 40 countries that are all kind of part of this experiment. And sometimes we're succeeding and sometimes we're failing. But the, you know, a lot of what we're moving towards is the idea. One of the things that I started to learn quickly is that the idea of a lecture, and I think how you and I got connected is I was reposting something from NPR, where physicists had done all this math and realized that the lecture doesn't really work. And
yeah, but you can't trust physicists. Everybody knows that.
Yeah. No, so the this is something that I had kind of come to a long time ago. You know, when I was in the late 90s, I mean, part of why the Pixel Corps got created was this issue of, I was teaching at San Francisco State University's multimedia studies program. And I was working at, and I just thought, you know, it's all the lecturers. If they just had good teachers, this would make a difference. And so I'm working on Star Wars, and, you know, for ILM, and teaching in a couple of evenings a night at the Multimedia Studies program. And I thought that I was going to be able to revolutionize everything. And, you know, and I just felt like I was, you know, trying to run through molasses, you know, needy molasses, trying to move things down the path. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that the lecture, trying to introduce all those things, you're always slowed down to the lowest common denominator. And I don't mean that in a bad way. There's one person doesn't understand this, and there's another person that doesn't understand that, and then this person has a loopy question, and this is, you know, there's all this stuff that goes on. And generating that content was not necessarily efficient. And so I didn't know what to do with that, but I just knew that it wasn't working. And then I was teaching some classes in Philadelphia. And one of the things that we got in this situation where I kind of double booked the class. I mean, there was some kind of miscommunication. I ended up with two classes at the same time for a week, and they're all day classes. And so I ended up in the situation where what I did was I recorded. I would sit there and do a very short lecture, 5 or 10 minutes, and record it. And then once I figured out that we were going to be double booked, I kind of spent the night before trying to figure out how I was going to manage this little car wreck, because there's like 15 people in each class or something like that. And so what I did is I would come over and lecture for 10 or 15 minutes and talk about a new concept and show them how to do it. And I'd record it, and I'd set up everybody's public folder to be one folder on my computer. And so I would record it all with, you know, with iShowU or Snaps or whatever, and then throw it in there. and then go over to the other and tell everyone, okay, now try that. And you have a movie now that you can kind of play with and look at it and everything else. I go over to the other class and do the same thing and then keep on doing back and forth, which is a little schizophrenic, but it was, what was funny was, is by the end of the class, you know, we'd covered more information than I had the year before when I only had one class and I was talking the whole time. And what I realized was this kind of asynchronous teaching, was extremely powerful, especially in skills development, was extremely powerful because then the people who were fast could get through it quickly and move on to the next thing. The people who were slow could repeat it over and over again, and they had plenty of time to work on it. And the people in the middle got pretty much the same experience they had before. And so that was the interesting thing. And then what we do, I spent most of my time after that, I started doing classes like this, and I spent most of my time just wandering around finding, you know, trying to fill in the holes and letting people work through those things. And so that became kind of the core of the concept that we're moving towards in some of the full education systems that we're about to start beta testing in Rwanda. We're building a media training school in Rwanda that should go into beta in February. And we spent 2 years kind of playing with the ideas of how we're going to do it. And a lot of it's based around four major things, which is, you know, movies, games, projects, and discussion. So the idea is that, you know, a huge percentage of the actual training, the objective training, in my opinion, should be movies. You know, you should be watching great videos that we planned. In the beginning, it'll be just videos that we can record. But what you should be looking at is, how do we make those videos great, you know, and very compelling and very, cover a lot of information very quickly. I think a great example of that when it comes to skills and understanding things is something like, I don't know if you've seen Alton Brown, but Good Eats, to me, as a training platform, is incredible. You know, you don't need to learn how to, I like to watch it. I cook a lot of the stuff that I see there, and I buy a lot of the stuff that he talks about. But the point is that the amount of information that Alton Brown pushes into, you know, 22 minutes of content is insane. You know, the amount of information that you're sucking up. Now, what you need is someone that does that for physics and math and English and everything else, that's talking in that first person. I'm going to show you these things. We're going to make it interesting. We're going to do all those other pieces. Then you need to have games and other things games and projects that force you to apply those things. So take those things and apply them, you know, and figure out how to create things. Now, in cooking is a good example. Go cook that and figure out whether you really understand it or not, and play with it. And if you get done with the one that you saw, build something that's just like it and keep on expanding on that. And then the final thing is discussion. So this is where, you know, you have, you start, you know, this is where the teachers come back into the puzzle. It is not about getting rid of teachers. What it's about is making sure that the teachers are doing something that's interesting for the students and interesting for the teachers, which is, take all these people who have already watched the movie, they've already played with some of the pieces, and while they're playing with them, have big discussions. And what's interesting about that is that we've done a bunch of these discussions, and what we have found, or what I have found in my experience so far, is that I really want a minimum of 80 people in that discussion. You know, I don't want 10, I don't want 20. I want a large number because I need to make sure that we reach critical mass where enough people are there that all the questions that need to be asked will be asked, and that you need a large sample to kind of get that to sort out in my experience. And so the thing is that you end up with a situation where you're kind of pressing towards larger class sizes. Now, people will say that will what happens to people who fall through the cracks? Well, there's a lot of tools now. You know, we're no longer in the 19th century. We don't have to do it. We still teach people the way we built Model T Fords. We haven't changed anything about that structure. We've added some little toys, but we haven't changed the entire structure to take advantage of the technology. So, for instance, you could be doing a lecture and asking, who was the president of, you know, you watch the Civil War, which is, you know, really what you should just watch, you know, for history class. For that era, if you want to learn about the Civil War, just watch the Civil War by Ken Burns. No one's going to, your teacher, the chances of your teacher covering it more effectively is very low. Or if you want to learn about physics, there was this Nova that talks a lot about, like, my daughter got into string theory when she was 10. She got interested in it because she watched some Nova and she knew it better than most college students by watching a 1 hour show, you know? So the key is utilize what the Discovery Channel, what Nova, what PBS does, what, you know, all these other pieces, you know, you figure out ways to utilize those, build your own, and then But make sure the student, you know, then have these big discussions. But you could be asking the students, if all the students are on computers or they all have iPads or iPhones or whatever you want to give them, and you ask them, you know, who was the president? You could know what every student thinks was the president during the Civil War in 10 seconds. You know, and you can very quickly start to gauge who's behind and who's ahead and so on and so forth. You can also be doing tests and stuff that they're doing while they're watching those videos. And then there's little things that they can do afterwards. But the students are working at their own speed. The fast students are not being held back. The slow students are not being left behind. You know, and again, the middle students are the middle students. But the middle, you know, the issue is, I think that school, the problem with, to get on the soapbox for just a second, you know, my, you know, I think the problem with school is it's designed by a bunch of people that were good at it. You know, and so the issue is with school is that people who are good at it, my wife is the perfect example. I have no degree. I'm not even sure if I graduate high school. And she has a master's degree from Harvard. You know, and so she, you know, she loves school and she loves digging into all of those things. She loves reading every, you know, extra credit thing that you can possibly read. And so she's really good at it. And to her, school was great. You know, high school was great. You know, it was a great experience for her. It's just that that's only a very small percentage of the actual students, because for most students, it was, you know, not a great experience. And we need to look at that. Like, how do we start taking care of all the students, not just the ones that are good at this crazy model that we created, you know, 500 years ago, and we've just been kind of replicating. And so I think that there are so many places, you know, and relying more on, you know, and I think that like Sal Khan, I wouldn't say that Khan Academy is the answer, but I think that there is a piece of that solution in there. But I think it does need, you do need to add the other elements, which is discussion, projects, you know, applying these things, games that allow you to play with those things. It's amazing how many military principles, you know, kids learn playing, you know, whatever it is, modern warfare or whatever they call that game. My son has it on his Xbox, and he's very good at knowing all the tactics of how all those things work. It would just be great if he, you know, was learning something that was actually applicable in his life, rather than how to, you know, but the point is that we, you know, games do, there's something about our psyche that causes us to pull all that stuff in, and games, you know, encourage us to do those things, and we should be finding ways to, you know, do much more of that. And there's, you know, and anyway, so it's, you know, that's the kind of stuff I think that we should be looking at. I think that also when we start looking at movies and everything else, I think the way we teach students, a lot of it has to do with what they can read. And the problem with that is that there are things that you want to teach them younger. You know, I think that there's a lot of things in physics, that you could teach them when they're five or six or seven years old. They can't read it, but they could play with it and they can watch movies about it and they would understand it. And but you have to kind of invert, you know, what they're getting there. Now you don't have to talk about the equations, but they can understand the principles of momentum, of gravity, of those types of things. But I think that a lot of times it's easier for them to do that by, you know, again, watching movies at their own pace and then having great projects. And I think you could free up a lot of time for these students to do more with projects and those types of things. If you, you know, because I think that it would be a lot more efficient rather than having, you know, 40,000 physics teachers reinventing the wheel every day. You know, you have the best presenters with the best graphics, with the best pieces, and everybody watches something like that. And I'm sure there's some teachers that are just like, can't even breathe. They're so upset with me right now.
Does your wife agree with you?
She thinks I'm crazy. But, you know, she.
That's okay. I do too.
No, I've ceased to try to persuade anybody in the United States that this is necessarily a good idea. So, you know, what we're kind of doing is we're experimenting with just media training. We're just going to keep it in a little box. Mm-hmm. And create some schools both here, and we're going to be building one here in Petaluma, and then this one in Rwanda that we're working with the Rwandan government on, which, you know, it's an experimental thing, and we're going to see how well that works. And then after we see how well that works, we'll look at applying it to, a wider range of training processes.
I think one of the difficulties with looking at education is that everyone thinks it's the same thing, that physics is the same as English, which is the same as history, which is the same as. And they are different disciplines with different things. And I think your approach for technical training and for skills is going to work really well.
Well, and I think it'll work well for math and physics. I don't know if it works well with, you know, I'm not sure. Like math, physics, and history to me are fairly objective. Not completely objective. And by the way, when I say discussion, what I mean by discussion is this is where the teachers are so important, because the discussion that's related to all of these things, which might be a third or a half of the entire curriculum, is creating the context for all the stuff that the people are, you know, so you're sucking up a bunch of information and then we have a big discussion to talk about, you know, the context of why that's important. You know, for us, you know, for instance, with what we're doing, I'm going to be bringing people in from all over the world to lecture. Not lecture, but have a discussion. I know, lecture. But when I say this discussion, it's a Q&A. So basically, we're going to bring guys in that used to work for or still work for big effects companies. And you have these students in Rwanda who are just learning the very basics. And these folks who have this experience will talk, will show some of the stuff that they've done. They'll answer questions. They'll create context. That's what that lecture or discussion or Q&A is all about. Now, I'm not bringing in a visual effects supervisor from a big visual effects company to teach them how to do green screen. You know, what I'm going to do is have them create a context, you know, for what those pieces are. Now, I do think that it's harder to do this with the humanities. I think it's harder to do it with, I mean, in some ways, English, there's mechanical pieces of what you have to do, you know, keeping, you know, understanding what a preposition is versus an adjective and so on and so forth. But then there's also just a whole lot of stuff that does require a lot more human interaction. But I think that, but we need to look at where we can use this to make it more efficient. I do think that people learn things differently. I absolutely agree with that. And I think different people learn things differently. And I think different subject matters learn differently. But what I will argue is that for millions of years, our brains were geared towards someone was going to show us how something worked, like viscerally show them how. We weren't going to read about it. You know, we were going to see it, you know, and I will argue that we spent millions of years developing that muscle. And the fact that school spends an enormous amount of time not doing that is, you know, it's fine. And there's some people who can develop that muscle, but I think that it goes against the way that our brains are built, you know, and that's in my very uneducated, undegreed mind. That's how it looks.
Well, I think you built a good case for vocational education, which is undervalued in this country.
Well, and I think that we need to think about what vocational education is. I mean, because there's an enormous amount of these things that need to get done. When I think of vocational, I don't think of, I think a lot of people think of Votech, as it was called when I was in high school, as, you know, working on cars and doing carpentry and getting better at metal shop and everything else. But the reality is that, you know, 95 to 98% of visual effects jobs could be considered Votech if you focused correctly. You know, there's a top percentage of the folks that you're seeing at, you know, these big visual effects firms and everything else. And that's in a whole different world, you know, of stuff. But there's most of the stuff that you see on TV is a craft. You know, like, you know, this is a, it's not an art. It's not a, you know, you're not, it's, it really is a craft, you know, and how you put that together is mechanical. You know, it requires, you know, you still have to develop mastery over many years of practice, but it is not something that, you know, there's an enormous amount of that work out there that is something that could be taught and approached like computers. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things in that area. And I know that I feel like when I see Votech schools right now or Votech sections within a public school, I always feel like they kind of tip their hat towards like some graphic design or something really basic, but they don't really take it as seriously as they do the more, you know, analog parts of their curriculum. And that might just be from their own history. And I think that is a, in my opinion, and as I said, I haven't seen it in the last couple of years, but you know, this has been my experience. In my opinion, that's a huge oversight.
I want to thank Alex Lindsay for joining me today. Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.